Markets kind of playing out exactly as we kind of thought they would at this point. But as you can see in those bottom two panels, we are very overbought. And those are very short-term indicators. That doesn't mean market's overbought, we're about to have another 10% correction, right? That's not what that means at all. It just means that we could spend, a few days kind of working off some of this overbought condition. It can move very quickly. And so if you kind of retest that 50, hold on to it, then that's another great entry point to add some exposure to your portfolio.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, welcoming you here at the end of yet another week for a weekly market recap featuring my good and senescent friend, Lance Roberts. How you doing, Lance?
I'm doing good today.
All right. Senescent, buddy. Characterized by the process of aging. And I picked that word for today because it's your birthday, big guy.
Happy birthday. Not yet. Sunday. I was born on Mother's Day. So yeah, but almost 2 days.
All right. Well, birthday weekend. Congratulations, my friend. You only turned 41 once in your life. Go have a fun time.
Exactly. 41 for the last 18 years. So
that means you've got a big birthday next year.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's very interesting because my wife and I have been watching this series on Netflix called A Man in Full with Jeff Daniels, Diane Lane, Lucy Liu. And it's such a depressing series. It's really a good show. So it's about this guy. He's like a real estate mogul. He's in debt. The bank's after him. And, how's he going to get out of this whole mess? It's really depressing to watch because all these people that, I watched and, Lucy Liu and Charlie's Angels and Diane Lane, Under the Tuscan Sun and Jeff Daniels and, a variety of movies. They're so old now. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, am I really that old? And yeah, I am that old now.
Well, you know what they say, buddy? It's not how old you are. It's how old you look. You look great. We'll definitely have to do a big Thoughtful Money celebration next year when you turn the big round number.
Perfect. All right. We'll plan on doing that one live somewhere. So I'll come out to you. You come to me, something. We'll figure it out next year.
I totally agree, but we really got to put some parameters on that because as folks can tell, I'm not in my normal studio. I'm actually in Houston where you are.
Yeah.
And folks are going to wonder, why are we not recording this together? It's just because our schedules just didn't work up to make it happen. And as you were just telling me before we hopped on here, no matter where you are from somebody in Houston, it's at least 40 minutes to an hour to where they are.
Exactly. That could be literally like two streets over and you get caught in traffic. It's 40 minutes. So.
Well, I'm here. We've got some dear family friends who I'm now at the age where our friends' children are getting married. Yeah. So I'm here at a celebration for one of their daughters' marriage. But I'm operating on 3 hours of sleep. I'm on day five of a 5-day fast. I don't know where I am. I don't know where's up, where's down. So who knows what we're going to get today, folks, from this weekly market recap. Definitely flying more without a safety net than normal. But lots to talk about, some interesting recent data releases. Real quick, just before we get to what's happened in the markets this week and the data that just came out, I want to just quickly ask folks watching, if you haven't signed up yet for our newsletter, for the Thoughtful Money newsletter, my Substack, please go do so. Totally free to sign up. And the reason why I'm asking folks to do that, it's not just a shameless plug, but I'm seeing more and more YouTube creators that are unwittingly kind of falling afoul of some of YouTube's algorithms in terms of censorship or just the subscribers that were subscribed to the channel are not subscribed to the channel anymore. And look, I love YouTube. We're going to stay on it as long as it lets us stay on it. And we're really not that, and I don't think we're really that controversial. But there are certain scenarios where I might not be able to bring videos to folks on YouTube. And if you sign up for the newsletter, that's a way to stay in touch directly with me and Thoughtful Money going forward. And so it's really just sort of an insurance policy. So folks, if you haven't signed up for that free newsletter yet, please go do so. Just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. You'll see the newsletter link up there at the top of the site menu. Click it, just sign up. Like I said, it's totally free to sign up. If you want to upgrade to all the benefits that come with premium membership, great. I'll tell you what they are at the end of today's video. But mostly I'm just asking, if you haven't signed up yet, take just 2 seconds right now. Go do that while you're listening. Okay, so interesting week, Lance. Strong week for the markets. Yep. You'll tell us how the S&P did, but definitely Big Mo is back, as are the stock buybacks, which you told us about last week. We've also had some really interesting data just come out this morning about consumer sentiment. And we got some interesting, a change finally in the jobless claims numbers, which we'll talk about too. But why don't we start with the strength in the markets? This is looking like pretty bullish momentum, correct?
Well, yeah, so far looking, and markets are a little bit, you know, ahead of themselves right now. So we need a day or two of correction, and and looks like we're kind of getting that on Friday a little bit. Markets opened up, and you and I are recording on Friday right now. So, we're still very early in the day, but the market opened up pretty nicely this morning, sold off, gave up some of that recent gain. And that should be expected, right? We've had 8 straight up days in the markets just since that. So we had that decline, then we basically 8 days straight up. So, again, we got back above the 50-day moving average. That's very bullish, suggests that we're back into the bullish trend, still very much intact, nothing to really be stressed out over there. So what would be great, honestly, is as we get a pullback here over the next, day or so or three, that retests that 50-day moving average and turns that now previous resistance back into support. So, I would actually, it would actually be great, get a little bit of a pullback here, kind of let the markets just take a quick breather, and then we make another potential advance as we move further into the month.
Okay, Lance, maybe it would be worthwhile, if you can, to bring up the chart of the S&P, just so sure. Folks can see where that line is. If possible too, I'm gonna ask you to bring up some of your SimpleVisor charts that show, market breadth. I'd like to see that quadrant scatter plot just to see if we're continuing to see a broadening out of the market, because that would be quite bullish too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So here, let me just kind of square some things away here for you. So this isn't my ideal chart here. I've actually got a couple of that I wanted to show you today. I've got two I wanted to particularly show you today. So about a week or so ago, in the middle of that kind of zoo, as we were bottoming along that kind of that 50-day moving average, or that 100-day moving average, that's that blue line. I wrote an article for our daily market commentary. So every day we put out this daily market commentary, just kind of laying out some interesting topics, but mostly focuses on kind of what to expect for the trading day. So earnings, economic data. And so I laid out this chart, putting out 3 pathways for the market. And this was just before the market broke above the 50-day moving average. And I said, there's 3 pathways. So path A, the market gets above the 50-day, and we kind of just, kind of rally from there a bit. Path B is a failure at the 50-day. We retest the 100-day moving average, again, that blue line. The 50-day is the red line. We retest that 100-day moving average and then, bounce from there and just kind of keep grinding sideways in this consolidation. Pathway C was where we took, failed at the 50, took out the 100 and retested the 200. And I gave them kind of an order of probabilities. I said, A is the most probable, B is the is probable, possible, and C is the least possible. And that was based on kind of market dynamics, where we were, markets were oversold, and we were starting to trigger a buy signal. So obviously since then, the market climbed above the 50-day moving average, and we're running right along that kind of path, right? Back towards what will ultimately be the highs that we set back in March. So, markets kind of playing out exactly as we kind of thought they would at this point. But as you can see in those bottom two panels, we are very overbought. And those are very short-term indicators. That doesn't mean markets overbought, we're about to have another 10% correction, right? That's not what that means at all. It just means that we could spend, a few days kind of working off some of this overbought condition. It can move very quickly. And so if you kind of retest that 50, hold on to it, then that's another great entry point to add some exposure to your portfolio. Now, having said that, if we do take out the 50-day for whatever reason, we got the inflation report next week. If that inflation report comes in a lot hotter than expected, that's certainly going to, you know, lead to some angst in the markets. But now the Fed's going to have to hike rates, not cut rates. We'll go through that whole scenario again with the market. And that could certainly lead to this market selling off, breaking out the 50, retesting that 100-day moving average. Regardless of what happens, I think we're pretty much contained right now, at least for the moments, between that 100-day moving average, that blue line, and recent highs. So I think we're stuck in that range here for a little bit. One of the reasons I say that is that, you know, May, June, and July tend to be fairly strong months for the markets. Now, when you say strong months, we're talking about a month that gains 1% versus loses 1%, right? It's not 10% in June. I'm not saying that. It's like June and July tend to be about positive, about 1% on average a month. So again, you know, we could be a couple percentage points higher theoretically in the markets, maybe challenge old highs, maybe take out old highs just by a smidge. The risk that we've got coming up is September, October. And I think that we're going to have another 5 to a 10% correction in September, October, only because, not because of economic data, not because of anything else, only because Wall Street is not going to want to be extra long stock, most likely, going into what is potentially going to be a very contentious election cycle. So once we get past that, once we know who the president is, we know who the policies are, then markets will probably rally into the end of the year. But I think there's a reasonable risk later this summer that we get another 5% correction or so, could be up to 10 before that election cycle, just simply a de-risking of portfolios.
Sure. Okay. All right. We'll be watching that 50-day moving average really closely here in the short term, right? It pretty much to see if it's going to be either support or if it fails to be support, then we start looking at the 100-day, right?
Right, exactly. This is the other chart I was just going to show you real quick, because this is something that's is both very interesting in a way, and it's also, you know, very bullish at the same time. So back in 2022, we formed the base of what's called a cup and handle pattern. And that 10% correction that we had last summer formed the handle of that pattern. So it's a very bullish pattern. So we held support with making that cup. And that was from the low going back to March of 2022. We then broke out and have now completed that cup and handle pattern to the upside. So that's a very bullish pattern, suggests that really the way you calculate the upside is basically you take the declination and add it to the breakout. So you're talking about between a market that could hit somewhere between 55 and 5600 this year. If this pattern continues to play out as statistically and technically says it should. So there's some decent upside in the markets this year. And again, that could be a result of the election, and we get a favorable outcome in the election. There's no, you know, we just get an election, nothing dramatic happens. We just, you know, elect somebody and they go to work and everything is fine. We don't have a major upheaval in the economy. But, you know, what is interesting is that, you know, during this 5.5% correction that we had in the month of April, it was very interesting to watch the volatility index. That's that red line. We spent 15 days going from 13 to about 20 on the index, and it took basically 13 days to go from 20 back to 13. So there's absolutely no fear, you know, in the markets right now. Again, we're overbought short term, expect a little bit of a correction. But, you know, for all the things that were going on during that correctional process, I mean, I was getting emails about, you know, this is, you know, it's inflation. Inflation's going to the moon. The Fed's got to hike rates and volatility never went anywhere. So it was just interesting that the markets remained, despite all the headline risk during that correction, the markets remained very, very complacent.
So totally evident here by the charts, and folks were talking about the red line there in the chart. So let me just ask you this, Lance. So obviously, for those that are making the case that markets are too overvalued and they're going to correct and all that stuff, you would expect to see a rising VIX, you know, into some sort of corrective event. So with VIX being super low, doesn't feel like any big rollover is imminent. Let me just ask you, and I know we've talked about this once or twice before, how accurate a gauge is the VIX these days? You know, there are a lot of people out there that are saying it's kind of a broken indicator.
No, it's not broken at all. So actually, we just as an example, when, you know, we, because you and I were talking about this correction that was going to come, right? So back in March, you and I were talking about, hey, February and March, right? I kept kind of ad nauseum every week you and I are on here. It's like, well, expect a 5% correction at least. You know, it could be 10% expected. It's going to happen. And you remember, it was all about AI in February and March, you know, where everything's going to the moon. Volatility was very suppressed. And we actually, in our model that we run options in, we actually took a hedge on the VIX at that point, expecting a spike in the VIX, which actually worked out very well for us. But it's not an indicator. Okay, first of all, the VIX isn't broken. The second thing is, it's not an indicator that is going to tell you anything ahead of time. Okay. It is a coincident indicator. So in other words, we were looking at the markets going, the markets are going to have this correction. We're very overbought. We're extended, deviated, you know, from the 200-day moving average, extremely deviated from the 50-day. We've got a rollover in breadth. So the correction that was going to come in the markets was pretty evident. It wasn't reflected in the VIX at all, but the overall correction was coming. And what all the VIX tells you is that in the midst of a correction, you know, it spikes. And again, you go back to the financial crisis. It didn't really, and this is that huge spike in the middle of the screen here back in 2020 when we shut down the economy. You know, going into in February, VIX was rising a little bit and wasn't really telling you much at all. And then we shut down the economy and VIX flies through the roof, right? Yeah. Well, it's completely coincident. There's absolutely no leading evidence in the VIX. And this goes back throughout history. I mean, we can run this chart all the way back to 2000 and look at it, you know, and during the dot-com crash, during the financial crisis. It's just not, it's not a good indicator to use for managing your portfolio or anything else. But it is a good indicator of telling you when volatility is afoot, right? So if you are getting a break in the markets, and again, what I would expect to see in this recent correction, the volatility index did pick up here a little bit, and you see you can barely notice it on the screen now, but you know it did pick up, but there was nothing really breaking in the markets, right? Nothing was there was no credit risk. If you take a look at, we talked about before, the one, if you want to have a predictive indicator of the markets, right? So, if let me give you an example. Let's say you interview somebody and they say, oh yeah, we're on the cusp of having a financial crisis. A, B, or C is going to happen. And this is going to be the next, leading indicator for the financial crisis. All you have to do to verify if that is true information or not is to go look at credit spreads.
Look at credit spreads, yeah.
Right, because credit spreads will factor, credit spreads factor all that in, right? The spread between the triple C and the triple B, triple C, single A, triple C, triple B versus single A or double A, you know, whatever. You can use a variety of spreads. And we actually have a chart where we look at a whole variety of different spreads that occur during market downturns. And those do, by the way, provide a good leading indicator of what's happening in the economy. So if you start to, credit spreads are not rising right now, there's no risk in the markets in terms of credit. And so there's no leading indicator that this was anything other than just a normal kind of garden variety correction, which is what it turned out to be.
Okay. And, you know, credit spreads over the past, recent years have been really tight. Yeah. Are they still in really tight mode?
Yes.
Okay.
and this is the interesting thing right now. So if you take a look at, so just let me do a little quick primer on this real quick, just so everybody's on the same page.
Sure.
So when you talk about corporate bonds, there's what is called investment grade bonds. And those are corporately issued bonds. So GE or Microsoft or whoever issues a bond. And what banks and pension funds, et cetera, can invest in have to be generally, there's probably some exceptions. I don't know of many if there are, but generally, if you're running a pension fund or a hedge fund or something like that, you're pretty much, unless you're a junk fund, you're pretty much relegated to what's called investment grade bonds. And those are bonds that are rated triple B or better. So triple B, single A, double A, triple A.
Right. And just trying to check, let me just give an example. So Apple would be a good investment grade bond because it's a big company, it's very profitable, and it has a mountain of cash. So your likelihood of getting paid back on your bond is quite high.
Right. And that, and we actually own Apple bonds for some of our clients and in our kind of our option-based model. That and those are what we consider to be money good, right? Because it doesn't matter what happens with, you know, Apple sales. They've got so much cash on the balance sheet, they could pay off all their debt today, right? So, you know, there's, so those are, but, you know, but that's, you know, that's, I don't know what the exact rating is right now, but it's an, I believe it's an A rated bond at the moment. But you look at the rating, right? So you just look at ratings, you say, okay, triple B or better. Now, here's my point about this. The differential, so I can go out and buy a triple B rated corporate bond, right? And let's say that I'm going to get, you know, 5% of my money to buy that triple A, that triple B rated bond. Well, the yield is a function of the risk and the rating, right? So the rating is basically kind of telling you what the risk is. Now, you know, triple B is right at the bottom of investment grade, which means that their balance sheets are okay. There's nothing wrong with them. But, you know, if anything kind of goes wrong, they're going to be dropped down to double B pretty quick. So, you know, they're kind of right on that cusp of being an investment grade bond. So there's risk there. And so for that risk, you should be paid more for taking that risk versus a guaranteed triple A rate, double A rated US Treasury. Well, right now, the differential between those two interest payments is very, very small. In other words, you're not being paid for the risk in buying a double B rated or triple B rated corporate bond versus buying a government guaranteed US Treasury. So in your portfolio, you should buy US Treasuries rather than triple B rated bonds because they're, you're just not being compensated for that risk differential.
Got it. Got it. And obviously, when people start getting worried about the economy or certainly worried about the credit system continuing to function, the bondholders start saying to anything that isn't as rock solid as a treasury, hey, I want to be compensated more for that risk. And so the spreads start widening. Right. And you'll hear analysts like Lance say in times of real worry, they start blowing out. Right. Where people start saying like, look, I want to hide in treasuries. So if you're going to try to convince me to invest in your low investment grade debt or your high yield or otherwise known as junk debt, I need a really big yield to make me comfortable on that.
Right. And that's the interesting thing about this is that in times of stress, what you'll see is you'll see spreads between corporates and treasuries, corporates and corporates, et cetera. Those will be the interest rates on those will be moving higher and the yields on US treasuries falling. So they go in the opposite direction during times of stress because everybody's selling the risk to buy the government guarantee of safety.
Right, and that's a great point. So they're pushing the higher the riskier debt rates higher, but because everybody's scrambling for the safety of treasuries, they're willing to take lower yields because they just want safety, right? So they're actually pushing those yields down. So yeah, you get that. I guess that's why you call it blowing out because both sides are moving apart from each other. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, look, Lance, we'll keep our eyes on credit spreads. Obviously, I mean they've been pinned in this tight range for a long time. But if we start to see divergence, that's one of the things folks that we'll highlight really brightly here, in this weekly market recap with Lance going forward. All right, Lance, if possible, can we switch over to the rotation charts that you have here and just see if the market is continuing to indeed broaden, if breadth is improving, because again, that's something I think you said you were looking for, and that would be a sign that the bullish action in the market is more sustainable than if it were just all crammed into the Magnificent Seven, like it was at the beginning of the year.
Exactly. No, it is interesting because actually, and this kind of goes into a couple of the trades that we've been building over the last couple of weeks, is utilities have been by far and away the biggest gainers over the last really kind of couple of weeks in particular. From a relative basis, discretionary, healthcare, transportation, energy, real estate, which are all interesting, right? Because a lot of those are very interest rate sensitive sectors, are actually performing a whole lot better. So we're starting to see everything kind of move from that lower left quadrant, kind of more back up to this upper right quadrant. We're not there yet, which means this market probably has some more to go, but, you know, definitely starting to see that rotation in the overall market. But what's been interesting is that the leaders in that rotation have been some areas that we don't normally have not really been bullish on, excuse me, because of interest rates, real estate, utilities are very interest rate sensitive. So utilities have been under a lot of pressure and real estate's been under pressure. So utilities are performing way better than, of course, real estate is right now, because obviously there's still some stress in the commercial real estate market, et cetera. We touched on that last week. But utilities are performing a lot better because now what people are figuring out is that in order to have AI, and this is the same thing with gold and gold miners, right? So if you're going to own gold, you have to own the picks and the shovels to go dig for the gold. And it's the same idea. If you're going to have electric cars, and now remember, this is all on top of the already massive power consumption that we use every day, from lighting to videos to computers to cell phones and all that other stuff that needs electricity. We're now adding in this drive to have more and more electric cars. California wants to have no gas powered cars by, I think, 2030, something like that. So that's just a massive amount of power consumption that's going to be there. So we've got to build out infrastructure and power consumption on that front. And this was something we talked a little bit about last week, Adam, is that we had bought a position in American Electric Power to mm-hmm. add to our position in Duke Energy in the dividend equity model, because that kind of covers a lot of the regions where the big data centers are for AI. So the more that we do AI, the more you need for data centers, the more that you need, that's going to require more power consumption. And so that's really leading to this push in the infrastructure supply and build out of the electric side of our economy.
So it's interesting. You have this, boring old sector, right? The utility sector just churns out electricity, churns out energy. And all of a sudden the AI craze that everybody, got so caught up in over the past year, they're now realizing, wow, to power all this AI, which is very energy and electricity intensive, we're going to need a lot of energy. And so all of a sudden this sleepy, boring, slow growth corner of the market is all of a sudden kind of getting this, almost kind of speculative premium on it, right?
It is. And look, the utilities got a little bit ahead of themselves at the moment. I would expect them to cool off a little bit, but again, as always, things are going to rotate in the markets. But again, it is, to your point, very interesting that now this is kind of been this coming shift, is everybody was chasing AI stocks. So NVIDIA, AMD, et cetera. Now they're going, okay, but wait a minute, they're going to need electricity. So companies like GE Vernova, which is the spinoff of GE. So GE basically broke themselves up over the last few years. General Electric has been breaking themselves up. They sold off all their, like refrigerators and appliances. They've kind of sheltered off their finance section. They broke up GE into GE Aero. So if you buy GE stock now, just the symbol GE, that's GE Aerospace. And the new spinoff is GE Vernova, which is basically generators and all of the electricity production and financing for utilities. So that stock's just been on a tear here recently. And we added a small starter position to that, just because that kind of diversifies our utility holdings between the actual provider and the infrastructure side of it.
All right. Hey, can you do me a favor here? So you're showing us some of the charts in the new Simplivisor platform, which are awesome. This chart, when you have all the companies on there, kind of looks like somebody let your 2-year-old loose with a box of crayons and a bare wall. Can you just sort of maybe just pick one stock and explain how to interpret the chart? Because it basically is showing the path of, any one of these indices through these different quadrants. And so you can kind of almost see the trajectory that it has and the possible momentum that it has.
Yeah. So the tail, right? So the part you're talking about, which is the scribbly part, that is basically just where it was. So what happened? So this is the absolute score on the bottom, and this is the relative score on the top. So this is absolute performance. This is absolute relative performance versus the S&P 500, right? So if the quadrant itself, the black lines, that's the S&P 500. Okay. So what we're looking at is if a sector or a factor of the market, is it outperforming the S&P? Is it underperforming the S&P? Is it overbought on a relative basis and an absolute basis, or is it oversold? And so the legs, or so to speak, are that, or that tail. And so here's 11 weeks. So this is, you can see that 11 weeks ago, utilities was trading and oversold on an absolute and relative basis versus the S&P. Nobody wanted utilities. Now, over the last 11 weeks, there's been this piling in of people wanting to own utilities. And so as the idea of rate cuts coming and cooler inflation, and of course, this whole AI backbone into the energy space, this has garnered a whole lot more momentum. And so you've seen a change in that sector relative to the S&P, to where it is now very overbought versus the S&P 500. So your best buying opportunities are down here in the lower left. Your best selling opportunities to take profits are in the upper right-hand corner, which we did today. As an example, we trimmed off both Duke Energy and ExxonMobil, just taking some profits in those positions.
Okay. And that's your standard gardening that you always tell us about on this channel, right? Which is position sizing. When a position outgrows what you have allocated for in the portfolio, you're happy about it because it means you've got some gains, but you're intelligently saying, well, I'm going to bring that back to my target weight, and I'm going to take those gains off the table and lock them in and be able to tell my investors that, hey, I actually indeed got real gains for you, not on paper gains, but real gains.
Exactly. And like, so here's real estate is a good example. You know, I said that utilities and real estate are usually pretty close compatriots in terms of performance because of their interest rate sensitivity. But you can see that real estate hasn't performed nearly like utilities because of it doesn't have the AI, you know, thing to it, right?
So that, and it also has a lot of worries about particularly the commercial real estate sector, like as you said.
Correct.
You know, utilities don't have that. They don't have a big shoe everyone's expecting to drop right now.
That's absolutely correct. And again, you know, we can do the same analysis looking at, you know, at sectors of the market. So you can say, as a good example, again, black quadrant is S&P. So how is mid cap and say small cap or low, or say, or just say even low beta, how's that performing relative to the S&P? And so basically, mid caps are basically kind of tracking performance of the S&P. They're not really outperforming. They're not really underperforming. Same thing for low beta, low volatility. So this is also a good way of saying, okay, if I'm wanting to invest and I want something that is going to outperform the S&P, I can do the same analysis to find out what's performing better than the S&P on both up and down. Right. Got it. During market declines, I can see what's working versus what's not working. You know, another one has been RSP. Here's a good example, right? RSP has been lagging S&P because it doesn't have the Mag 7 in it. It has the equal weighted index, has the Magnificent 7 in it, but it doesn't have the weighting. So when everybody, again, we talked about before, is like when you buy an S&P index, 30 cents of every dollar goes into those top 10 stocks that or don't have that same weighting in RSP. So RSP has been very underperforming the S&P because of that lack of weighting of those 10 stocks.
Right. Which you would expect, you know, and how hot those stocks still are.
So this just kind of helps you, you know, if you're a do-it-yourself investor, right? This just helps give you some, you know, better kind of analysis of, you know, kind of where to look at providing performance in your portfolio. And we do the same analysis. We do what's called factor analysis. And this looks at performance on a relative and absolute basis. So this is excess returns over time of, say, we'll just take the first one, right? So here's IWM, that's kind of the Russell 2000 index. Over the last 5 days, it's lagged the S&P by 62 basis points. Over the last 20 days, it's had a 13 basis point increase. Over the last 20 days, prior to that. So this is 5 days. So 20 days to that is 25 days. Another 20 days is now 45 days. So it's adding to this. Over the last 45 days, it's underperformed by 1.92% and go on. So it's last 60 days, it has, and again, you kind of add these all together. So this is 180 days. It's underperformed the S&P by almost 9%. So, you know, this is just another good way to look at where two things this will tell you is, one, if you have a lot of red on the far right-hand side and it's turning more green, that means performance is now improving relative to the S&P. So as a good example of this, take a look at momentum down here. Momentum was outperforming, and then it started underperforming during that correctional process over the last 20 days, is now outperforming again. So we can see this rotation of performance between factors in the markets and saying, okay, we're starting to see something that was lagging begin to improve relative to the S&P. And this will also help you kind of identify how to weight your portfolio.
Really interesting. So I feel like we're kind of releasing little parts of the meal, you know, at a time here. And I know we keep telling people that one of these days we're going to do a real deep dive into the SimpleVisor platform because you are re-releasing it. Is now the time to do that, or do you want to have?
I knew you were going to ask me that. If you can just give me another week or so, we're finishing up with Fidelity right now, and we've got two more steps to go through with Fidelity. But what I want to do is, at the same time that we do this deep dive, I want to be able to also show people how they can sign up with Fidelity, open an account, select one of the models if they want to invest in one of the models. And we're going to have 10, we have our basic models, right? Our 60, 40, 80, 20, 70, 30, you'll have those, but you'll have 10 other models to invest in as well. AI, infrastructure, green energy. So we have 10 different models that you can choose from. So you can kind of build your own portfolio, invest in it, track it, and all that. So, but we're very close to having everything, all the APIs and everything created with Fidelity, so that you can just basically go online, open up an account, and start managing your own money. So we'll have that available. So I'd like to kind of just do that whole walkthrough at one time. And then I'm just in talks right now with Right Capital and Back Nine, which will also allow you to do some basic financial planning and buy insurance if you need term life insurance. Again, this is great for people that are just starting out investing. You've got less than $200,000. We've talked about the muscles you need to kind of get your financial house in order and start saving. Well, term insurance is a very important part of that. It's cheap. It hedges your family against a catastrophic loss, being you as the bread earner. And so we'll have access to that, to where you can go shop premiums, get cheap policies, and build that buffer, that in financial plan. So all that's coming over the course of this year. We've got a lot of innovations coming that'll help young investors really start moving in the right direction.
Okay, great. All right. Feel free to continue sharing whatever you want here, but yeah, we'll, folks watching, we'll do the big reveal, the full reveal, when the full solution that Lance just mentioned is up and running, so that it's not a tease. You can see it and then actually go do it right then if you want to. And again, just to reiterate for folks, SimpleVisor, in my mind, I'm super excited for this because it addresses two needs that thoughtful money isn't addressing as much as I'd like to at this moment, which is, as I've said, on this channel a lot recently, as an investor early on, you've got to make a big decision. Are you going to be your own financial quarterback, or are you going to recruit a good quarterback to be one for you? And honestly, as you hear me say all the time, the vast majority of people probably want to focus on recruiting a good quarterback because they don't have the experience, the time, the desire, whatever, to have to follow the markets and be researching specific securities to buy. And I think Thoughtful Money does a pretty good job in showing people what a good financial quarterback looks like, because we have you on, Lance, every week. We've got the New Harbor guys on. We've got the Canadian guys at RockLink on. So at least people can see what a good financial advisor looks like, use that standard to find someone that is an even better fit for them, or they can talk to you guys and maybe work with you. But if you're just starting out and you don't have enough assets yet for a financial advisor to create a customized portfolio for you and be able to do all the risk management and everything, this SimpleVisor solution is going to be awesome for those people, Lance, because it's that turnkey on-ramp, right? And then for the other people who say, look, I'm here for the information, but I want to be my own quarterback, SimpleVisor's got tons of information, tons of tools. People don't need to take my word for it because they're seeing it visually as we talk about this stuff here. And they get to basically look over your shoulder Lance, at all these different portfolios you mentioned, and they can copycat them if they want to. They can pick and pull what they like from them. So I feel like once this is out in the world, then we'll have a complete solution for people. It's either like, just give me the DIY tools and information, give me the turnkey solution if I'm just starting out, or give me a good financial quarterback who can do all this stuff for me.
Exactly. And look, if you're a DIY investor and like doing your own research, I mean, the platform is up and running. And again, this is just the homepage when you first sign in. Kind of gives you a market overview of the highlights, kind of tells you what stocks are moving in the market. So, you know, you can see what the top 10 winners are, the bottom 10, the most active, sector performance for the day. We have several of our stock screeners that we've made available. So it screens for stocks. Every time you log in, it's screening for stocks, gives you recommendations for relative strength stocks, momentum stocks, relative strength versus the S&P. Get access to all of our latest articles. Our proprietary fear and greed indicator and our technical indicator is there as well. So again, that's just the homepage. And then from there, you can start kind of working through all the different analysis that's there. You can do your own stock research. So if there's a particular stock that you're wanting to buy, say it's an Apple as an example, it does complete full research for you where you can look at it's, if it would help if I'd actually type in the right symbol. but when you start getting into this, it gives you kind of an overview of the stock. You can look at returns, stock transactions. You can take a look at dividends, equities and splits, earnings estimates. You can do advanced charting, fundamentals on the stocks. We give you a fair value estimate of Apple versus its peers. You can take a look at the earnings trend, the dividends trend, take a look at the amount of short interest that's currently out on Apple, insider stats, who's buying, who's selling. So options chain, it's all there for you. So if you want to do your own research, all of that analysis is already readily available for you.
All right. You're showing a lot of leg here, buddy. I'm going to let you open the whole kimono next time when you're ready. Yeah. But I do just want to underscore for the folks, because I think one of the main points you're trying to make here is you built this, meaning, if you're a DIY guy and you want to look at the stuff that you, Lance, look at the most when you're researching a company, whatever, you've kind of created your fantasy, set of instrumentation here to get everything that you like to get.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, for us, I mean, when we sit down in the mornings and we have our portfolio management meetings and we're talking about, different things, we're using this tool. So we're going into this performance analysis and we're analyzing what's performing. We're looking at the factor analysis and what's performing. One of my favorite things is if you go into portfolios, we have our portfolios, of course, and you can have your own on here as well. But I like one of my favorites is this, what we call the super investor portfolios. And this is basically every major. So here's Warren Buffett's portfolio, Dodge and Cox, First Eagle, the Gates Foundation, Pollen Capital Management. And we have just hundreds, we have just tremendous numbers of different portfolios from hedge funds, et cetera, that we all put in here. So you can pick up Daniel Loeb, Third Point, and look at what he owns. And
how do you get this? So is this a feed you license?
No, this is all from the 13. They're every quarter they have to file their holdings. And again, so we'll talk about what Warren Buffett bought or sold in a quarter. So we pull all that 13F information.
The 13Fs, got it. Yeah.
And so you can look at that on individuals, or you can look at how they're combined. So who owns, who owns globally the same holdings, right? So if you take a look at across all the super investors, what are their top holdings? Microsoft, Wells Fargo, Google, Schwab, Google, Comcast, those are their top big holdings. And you can see how they're weighted as a whole.
That's really cool. So, of the people who are, some of the most respected investors of the world, what are the things that they hold most in common? And you got to imagine, if some of the smartest, most successful investors are holding these things, they're probably pretty good to have in my portfolio.
It's a way to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So super interesting. We could geek out on this the whole rest of the time.
Yes, I know.
All right. Well, let me pull up. Is there anything else you want to?
No. That was it. I get excited when we start talking about it because I'm having a lot of fun with this.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited because we keep hearing about it. So, anyways, hopefully you're able to give us the full presentation soon. Yeah. All right. So, as I mentioned, there were some big data releases this week. Trying to figure out which one to start with. I guess let's start with sort of the surprise that came out this morning. The University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index came out and was a real downward surprise. It was at 77.2. It was expected to come down a bit to 76.2, but it came in at 67.4. And the reason why that's material is not only was it a miss, but it was like a seven figure miss. It was the biggest percent drop in the data set, at least going back to 2000. So really caught folks by surprise. I'm going to try to pull up that chart in just a second here. What was interesting is they asked people their confidence about current conditions, and they asked people their confidence about their expectations, about what they expect the future to be. So current conditions dropped by most on record. Expectations plunged pretty big too. It was at 76, was supposed to be at 75, came in at 66.5. And here's the interesting thing, at least the articles that I've read this morning, which is, you know, Jerome Powell, when he was talking last week, he said, you know what, I'm looking at this data, everybody's talking about stagflation, but I don't see the stag and I don't see the flation, right?
Yeah.
And consumers have basically said in this sentiment report, well, we kind of see both. So the quote here is, strength in household incomes has been the primary source of support for robust consumer spending over the past couple of years. So a softening in labor market expectations is concerning. And folks said they're worried about jobs going forward. And if it continues, this may lead to a pullback in the consumer's willingness to spend. This quote comes from Joanne Hsu, who's director of the survey that the Consumer Sentiment University of Michigan published. So that's the stag part, right? People are worried about the economy slowing down and the jobs market slowing down. And then when they asked people about their inflation expectations, they jumped from 2.5% to 3.2% and far above the estimates of what was expected, while 5 to 10 year inflation expectations also rose. So people are saying, yeah, we're looking ahead and we're seeing the inflation part. So, you know, Powell may end up being right, but his view of the road ahead looks very different, it seems, from what consumers are saying.
Yeah, be real careful with the data, because we had a market correction of 5.5% when they were taking that data. So there's a very high correlation between ebbs and flows in the market versus consumer confidence, particularly because if you take a look at their 1 year expectations on price gains, those were through the roof, right? That was like almost at an all-time high. They just thought back in February and March that stock prices were just going to keep going up. So one thing is to just kind of keep that in perspective is that when the market corrects, you're typically going to get a downturn in consumer confidence. Yeah. And they go,
I'll let you keep answering, but two things. Right. One, I'm just putting up the chart here so folks can see how big the drop is. If you look at the left hand at the bottom chart, you just see it just plunges way below any other data point there. But secondly, I guess, Lance, they changed the methodology of how they are capturing the data, and they finally went online for the first time. I think the UMich people are trying to say, well, be a little careful because of the change, because we think people are a little more bullish when you talk to them in person, which at least some of the articles I read seem to suggest, like, I think you guys are just trying to put some lipstick on this thing. And honestly, people are probably just more honest when they're able to answer online. So who knows? We'll find out.
No, it is true is that, you know, when you're totally anonymous, people will tend to be, I guess you say it more honest than if you're taking somebody in person, right? And they go, who are you voting for this year? You're going to vote for Biden or Trump? And they're going, well, let's see, where am I right now? I'm going to vote for Biden. They might actually mean they're going to vote for Trump, but they're just, you know, depending on their surroundings and kind of what they feel, it can influence their decision. So yeah, online is certainly something worth paying attention to. But if you look at that drop, you know, we had a very similar drop back in, you know, couple of months ago, and you had a similar drop, you know, prior to that. So this is a very, you know, volatile data set.
Well, wait a minute. Where's the similar drop? This thing is like,
well, that, what's your orange line that I'm looking at? In the, it says actual versus expected, University of Michigan. What's that orange line?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the, I'm looking at the bottom line, which I believe is the percent change.
Got to be percent. Yeah. But percentages are deceiving. You got to be careful with that. So again, what I'm saying is that the data is very volatile. So you can have these, like next month, if this market keeps rallying, you're going to have a big up number and you'll have a big jump to the upside. So I'm just saying, be careful. Just don't go base your whole decision on this one index, because it's a very volatile number.
Yeah. Okay. And I think actually now the bottom one here, I think it's the delta between the expectation and the actual, meaning what the analyst thought versus what it came in at. Yeah.
Correct. Now also, the conference board measure of consumer confidence is vastly more optimistic than the University of Michigan. And that's not normally the case. Normally these two track fairly closely together, but ever since 2020, there's been a very big gap between the conference board and University of Michigan. So the conference board says everybody's fine. University of Michigan has been saying for a long time now that consumers aren't that confident about the economy. Which one's correct? I don't know, right? I'm just saying that there's a big gap to pay attention to.
Got it. Well, so we had some, I'm going to connect this to some other data that came out this week, actually just yesterday, I think, which was jobless claims, which, you know, we've been pointing out, we're not the only ones who've been doing this, but that the jobless claims numbers have just been like pool table flat. Yeah. For a while. And Jim Bianco had put out a report showing that for one recent period, I think 5 of the 6 prints were exactly the same number, which was actually kind of like statistically impossible. So, you know, we've been talking about a lot of the data being put out by the BLS and how massaged it seems to be. And we've obviously talked about, you know, things like birth death calculations, muddying things up and all that stuff. But anyways, I think it's notable with this recent print that we actually saw a material jump. So jobless claims jumped to their highest level in 8 months. They were up 22,000 to 231,000. The data that has said, hey, nothing's wrong. This isn't calamity by any stretch. But you know, it's finally actually moving, in a mildly, we'll say right now, mildly concerning direction. You and I have talked about where we think jobs are headed. I've sort of been, you know, on the side saying that I think the job numbers are the initial claims numbers are quite underreported, especially when you've looked at this year, the increase in layoffs that we've had this year, the, you know, explosion in WARN notices and stuff like that. So you can see here, I mean, it's a pretty notable jump right now. These are not danger ranges at all yet in terms of initial claims, but it just sort of suggests that perhaps the strange tranquility that we've had may be ending. And I've got some additional data to add in a second, but I want to see if you get any initial thoughts, Lance.
Yeah, I would be really careful with this number because two things that went on. First of all, you have a lot of temporary tax prep helpers that just got laid off, right? Because it's April the 15th is over. So a lot of those temp hires for tax prep, they lose their job. Also, you had a very abnormal surge in the seasonal adjustment in New York claims. So if you take a look at a couple of things here real quick. First of all, jobless claims are kind of tracking the normal seasonal pattern. So during these weeks, we tend to be at kind of lower levels and you kind of get a spike in jobless claims heading into the summer. Not surprising. People coming out of school, going on vacation, you know, for the summer break, all that type of stuff. So you have a lot of people getting terminated. And then you tend to have another fall off in the fall, and then you have another rally into the end of the year. So, you know, nothing really abnormal going on with jobless claims at all right now. But there was a very big adjustment to New York. So there's been two things that have been going on. California has not been reporting their jobless claims as much as you would expect. And so that's been providing a suppression to jobless claims. And then this week, you've had this very big seasonal adjustment to the New York claims, which is well outside the norm. So that's got to resolve itself next week. So the next time we get jobless claims, that may all temporarily reverse itself, right? We have another very low number next week. So again, just be careful, you know, kind of reading into it. The thing to really pay attention to is not the week-to-week jobless claims, it's the continuing jobless claims. So week-to-week is simply, I lost my job this week, so I go file next week. That's my first claim. So that's initial jobless claims. That's the first time I file. If I get a job right after that, I'm back off of it. But if I continue to file, that now becomes a continuing jobless claims. That's the number to watch. So if you're really worried about employment beginning to slow down, we should start to see a fairly sharp increase in these continuing claims. In other words, I've lost my job and I can't find another job. So right now, there's not evidence of that. People, the continuing jobless claims continue to decline here, remain fairly low, which means people are losing their job. They're getting an initial claim, but within a fairly short period of time, they're getting reemployed.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. The continuing claims have been really suppressed as well. And they're not signaling any real worry right now. And this chart's a great one to show, where you can see the spike there in the most recent initial claims data, but the continuing claims hasn't yet moved at all. Now, we did talk, I think it was last week, where I mentioned caution about even looking at these jobs numbers, because they do, there's some potential undercounting that goes on, particularly amongst, you know, undocumented workers. But also, we talked about how so many states have not updated their unemployment benefits that in so many years, like California hadn't updated theirs in 20 years, which was mind-blowing, where people basically have said, look, if I jump through the hoops to take unemployment, I'm actually going to be less well off than if I actually just do some gig work or even some under the table work. So it's we don't have a great picture of what's going on here.
That's very true.
It's very true. Yeah. And so I was interviewing David Rosenberg this week, who, you know, his firm is Rosenberg Research. He was talking about some research that they just did at his firm using the QCEW, Lance, the quarterly census of employment and wages. And he thinks that's a much better source, because it's really not survey driven. And it's real data. And I think he said that there's something like 12 million inputs or something like that. So it's just a much richer and less subjective data set than the BLS's stuff. And through that analysis, he calculates, and we can argue whether he's right or wrong about this, but he calculates that current payroll data is overestimated in the government's reports by to the tune of like 800,000 to 1 million jobs right now.
That is correct.
And he also calculates that wages paid are overestimated by about 650 billion. So, you know, if true, then that is, I mean, those are real material corrections to what the official data is. And he kind of paired it with, you know, like if I look at the data, business bankruptcies are up 35% year over year. Gross new business formation is down 5% year over year. So, you know, I know Rosenberg's general opinions, and he's, you know, quite still thinks that the recession will be happening at some point. He thinks it's unavoidable. But you know, you hear, you know, evidence like that, and you're like, all right, that's worth paying attention to.
No, it absolutely is. In this weekend's newsletter, I'm actually kind of updating, kind of what's going on in the markets, you know, buybacks, those type of things. But one of the things that I point out in the newsletter is what's called residual seasonality. And right now in the first quarter, so this goes along with exactly what David's talking about, is that if you take a look at the season out, these seasonal adjustments that we make to the data, right? So we have the raw data. Let me give you a good example. So let's say we look at existing home sales as a data point. And you say, okay, so there was 1,000, there was 1,200 new home or existing homes sold in January. That's what the data tells you. So you go, wow, that's a lot. That's a lot of homes, 1,200 homes in a month, right? So, I mean, the housing market's booming. Well, the problem with that is that's seasonally adjusted. What they do is they take the number of homes that were actually sold and multiply it by 12. So it's assuming we're going to sell the same number of houses every month for the next 12 months. Well, what's 1/12 of 1,200? We sold 100 homes. So now when you start looking at it going, wait, you mean we sold 100 homes nationwide in January, right? Because that's what the number says. So it's a very different picture when you start looking at these seasonal adjustments that we add. That's a really easy one to pick on, so that's why I use it. But we use all these seasonal adjustments, right? The birth-death adjustment. How many businesses did we create versus how many did we die? Well, a lot of businesses are created as shelters. They don't have any employees. So, you know, you look at 60 million business formations, only about 7 million of them actually have employees. So what does that tell you in terms of birth-death? And then, of course, you know, business formations, if you actually get into it, have actually been declining, not rising. But we're adding employment to the roles based on this expectation that we're creating a bunch of businesses that are hiring people. So you got to be real careful with these seasonal adjustments. So the thing about residual seasonality is this, is that the seasonal adjustments got broke during 2020. Yeah. And because of this recovery in the economy, we've been overestimating a lot of this stuff to a great degree. And so in the first quarter, January, February, March of this year, we had an outsized level of seasonal adjustments to the economic data, which made it look like, man, the economy's booming. But over the next three quarters, that's going to run in reverse. So those seasonal adjustments will start backing down. So we're going to see slower rates of economic growth. Theoretically, we should see slower rates of employment. This is all disinflationary, by the way, but you know, that's what you should expect to see over the next three quarters. And I think because the Fed knows this data is why the Fed has not been, the Fed was pretty adamant, hey, we're not going to hike rates and we're probably still on path to cut rates. Because I think they see the same data. And since they're involved directly in this data, they know that this seasonal anomaly is going to start working itself backwards.
Okay. And this all ties back in some ways to your bond thesis. Correct. Yeah. Yep. Okay. Well, look, I'm going to, I might surprise you a little bit, Lance. I've got a reason to be a raging bull.
Nice.
If this happens. And of course, I think if it did happen, you and I would probably, shed some tears of depression too, at the same time. I've had a couple of great conversations this week, one of which was aired on this channel in the video prior to this one with housing analyst Melody Wright. Lance, I'm guessing that you have seen the Financial Times article written by Meredith Whitney that's been making the rounds about Freddie Mac applying to be able to enter the secondary mortgage market or the home equity loan market. And in at least in the article that was put forth by Meredith Whitney, you know, she was saying that could be a way to inject, you know, $2 trillion into consumers, bank accounts by the end of this year, right? I mean, who knows if it's going to pass and could it be implemented and whatnot? But anyways, personally, I think it's such a bad idea in so many ways. In other words, I see it as potentially, just repeating the sins of the past, the lessons we should have learned, from the first housing bust. But to me, it seems like such an elegantly bad decision right now in terms of a relatively easy way to get the stimulus in the consumer's hands that it's something that the government would. It just seems like something the government would definitely do because it's just that bad. Obviously, it'd be a huge stimulus to the economy. It would goose asset prices. It would eventually, I think, then be super inflationary. And then all these over-leveraged consumers would get in really huge trouble. And then we'd have to have massive bailouts. And there would be a massive cost to this. But it would turn me into a short-term raging bull if this happened. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think you're a little bit overstating it. So first of all, I like Meredith Whitney, but remember, she's the one that called for the crash of the muni market that never happened. So you got to take in, you've got to take analysis with a grain of salt, as always.
To me, this felt like it was weird. Because she's had some of these bearish outlooks. This was almost like a cheerleading piece. I mean, I would say it was a trial balloon piece, but the Freddie Mac has actually made the application. So yeah, they
have. And look, no, they have, but let's think about things let's bring things down to earth for a moment. Let's just think about a couple of things. So first of all, I heard analysis being made that this is going to be like the next subprime financial crisis situation, right? That's not. You know, the issue with subprime is we were giving home loans to people that had no jobs, no income, no ability to pay their mortgage, et cetera. So that's not the case here. This is home equity lines of credit. So this is basically, I own a home. So let's just use me as an example, right? So I sold my house a couple of years ago, as you know, and I bought a new house that I'm now remodeling, right? We paid cash from the sale of our old house for the new house. So I have no mortgage on my house now. At this point. So I could theoretically go take out a home equity line of credit on my house. Well, they're only going to loan me a certain loan to value ratio on that. They're not going to give me 100% of the mortgage, right? Or the value of the house. They're going to give me some ratio of that. So let's just say they're going to loan me 40 cents on the dollar. The bank still owns 60 cents on the dollar of that house. So if I default on my home equity line of credit, they take my house. They're good. They're golden, right? Because they have a loan to value based on that house. So this isn't going to put Fannie Mac or Freddie Mae, either one of them, whoever does this, in jeopardy. More importantly, we're already doing home equity loans. This isn't some new invention, right? I can go to the bank right now and take out a home equity line of credit on my house, right? That's available to me now. And so everybody that wants to take out a home equity line of credit, they have access to that. So this isn't like some new innovation that all of a sudden there's going to be $2 trillion worth of homeowners running out to say, oh my gosh, I didn't know I could take out a home equity line. I'll go do it now.
But my understanding is we do have a home equity loan market right now, yes, right? With the banks, but the banks have to meet their Basel III requirements. They can only make a certain number of loans because there are a ton of applications that they're saying you don't qualify, right?
Yeah. I'm not arguing the point. And the same things, but the same, the Freddie Mac's not going to just make a 100-cent loan on the house, right? There's going to be credit requirements. There's going to be payment requirements. There's going to be all that stuff. So my point though is that if somebody is in a position to take out a home equity line of credit, that means they have equity in their home that is worth taking, that they want to take out for some reason. Now, we're going to talk about the reasons why they take that out here in a second also. But this is, my point is that this isn't some new invention like subprime mortgages where all of a sudden we're going to give loans to people that don't have a job to go buy a house. That was a game changer, right? So that sent housing prices to the moon. This is people that already own houses and have equity in it. So now let's go to the next point. Why do people normally take out home equity lines of credit? Well, they don't normally take out home equity to buy or to go buy the next iPod or the next, Apple phone, whatever. They generally take out home equity lines of credit to consolidate other debt that's higher in interest rates. So that's not really inflationary at all, because all you're doing is moving one debt to another debt. That's the vast majority of home equity lines. Or they take out a home equity line of credit to do a remodel on their house. Now, that will feed into the economy because you're hiring construction workers and buying materials and those type of things. But this really isn't a consumptive tool that people are going to use. So to say that people are running out and borrow $2 trillion to be massively inflationary, that's probably a stretch because of the way that home equity lines of credit are used, which also, by the way, when you go to apply for home equity line of credit, they go, why do you want it? And you go, well, I'm doing debt consolidation. I'm doing a remodel. You know, that goes into the factoring of that. So again, I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm not saying that at all. So don't assume that I am. I'm just saying, let's not jump the gun and say all of a sudden there's going to be $2 trillion worth of flow coming into the economy, and we're going to have this massive economic growth and people are going to borrow money as their house to invest in the stock market, because that's probably not going to happen. Because if it was going to happen, it would have already been happening.
Yeah, I think it all comes down on what are the credit standards? How different is the credit standards from Freddie Mac, yeah, and if other GSEs
get? Oh, I'm sure they will be easier, no doubt. I'm sure they will be easier. But again, I just don't, you know, will people do it? Absolutely. Will people take out home equity lines of credit? Absolutely.
Well, absolutely. Especially if the consumers start struggling more, because as you say, they're creative. They will find ways to get whatever they can.
But you have to also think about this way. Even if I'm in trouble, right, as a consumer. So my wife is a great example of this. She doesn't really care about how much cash is sitting in the bank. Her whole world is around her house. That is her security. If I go and make really bad investments and blow everything up in, you know, financially in our accounts, which I better not do because she'll kill me. But, you know, if I did, she would be okay. She wouldn't be okay with it, but she would say, okay, hey, we're going to just pick back up and we're going to go back to work. The one thing I can't touch, and she will never allow me to touch, is to put the house in jeopardy, because that is her security. That is her home. That is her nest. And so you don't mess with that. And that's the way a lot of people feel about their houses. They go, look, you know, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs, and, you know, I'm struggling to make ends meet, but my home is all I have. And if I go take out a bunch of money against my house and I lose that too, now I've lost everything. So people are much more protective about the equity in their home than they are taking out a buy now, pay later program, right? Because that's just another form of credit. That's $700 billion worth of issue. So, you know, that's, you know, there's also those other impacts where just because somebody owns a home doesn't mean they're going to take an equity line of credit out on it. Because for most people, that's all the asset they have.
I hope you're right. Again, I'm fresh after talking to Melody Wright, who, you know, she's a mortgage analyst. I mean, that's her specialty. And so she has the scars from 2008, 2009 of, you know, helping or working with people, families who were losing their house to repossession. I sadly will probably admit to having a little bit less faith in the financial responsibility, even of the average homeowner here.
Like I said, there will people that absolutely, my point is yes, people absolutely do it. I don't think it's going to be the massive gold rush that everybody's assuming. All of a sudden we're going to extract $2 trillion worth. I mean, we could, I mean, you know, anything is possible. I just don't think we're going to see all of a sudden, you know, Freddie Mac turns this on and all of a sudden there's this gold rush of $2 trillion flooding back in the economy to go buy an Apple iPhone with it.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope personally this doesn't get passed. You know, we have a mortgage, we have a home equity loan market right now, and it would be doing more loans if the loans penciled out as good, responsible loans. To me, this feels very much like, the education market. And this is one of the things that blew my mind in the discussion with Melody, is she's saying that right now government has gotten increasingly involved in the mortgage market. And you know, when you get a mortgage from your bank, in most cases, your bank holds that mortgage for like a couple of minutes. and then it is sold. And 80% of the time, 85% of the time, it is bought by one of these government-sponsored enterprises. And so to a large extent, we are already a nation of borrowers from the government for our shelter. And Lance, my fear here is what you rail about an awful lot with the education loan market, right? Yeah. Which is once the government gets overly involved, it just deforms and distorts the systems in ways that ends up injuring everybody. Right, it's why we have such an incredibly expensive higher education system now, and why college tuition. I think of everything that has increased in price over the past couple of decades. I don't know if there's anything that's increased as much as college tuition has.
Right. Well, and again, it's always supply versus demand. But now you're seeing the consequence of that also, right? Which is, you know, prior to the government getting involved, you know, college educations were, you know, done through a bank, and you would apply for the loan and college tuition was reasonable. You go to school and get a degree. And then ever since then, We've had this massive explosion of students going to school. Everybody's got a bachelor's degree, and now nobody can get a job because, as we've talked about before, you've now turned the bachelor's degree into the equivalent of a high school diploma. So now you better have a master's or a PhD to set yourself apart. And so now we're getting this big, I see, you know, more and more people talking about, well, go to, you know, don't go to college, go to a trade school. That's fine. We definitely need trades, but it's all about supply and demand. Everybody quits going to college, and everybody goes to trade school. Now we've got a bajillion electricians and plumbers, their wages will crash because you've got too many people to do the jobs, right? So it's always about having an equitable.
Although I'd much rather have a glut of people who know how to do things than a glut of people with, you know, some random paper degree, whatever.
Exactly. But my point though is that if people would just leave everything alone, the natural economic cycle would take care of it itself. And so the supply demand imbalance would say, hey, look, we've got too many tradespeople. We need more college educated people. And so people will move back in that direction. People will figure this out. They'll go, you know what? If I really want a good job, I better go have a college degree, or I better get a trade skill. But we keep intervening, right? And so we keep distorting these capitalistic cycles that the market would resolve itself naturally over time if we would just leave it alone. But we keep doing things like requiring people to go to school till they're, get their high school diploma, making people go to college because we're demanding that and providing them money to do it. Doesn't matter if you can pay it back or not. Doesn't matter. Go to college. So we keep distorting the system, whether it's housing, whether it's college, whatever it is. If we would just leave it alone, these things would resolve themselves over time.
And that's my whole point beneath this whole expanding the home equity loan market by getting the GSEs involved and probably lowering standards. And then, of course, people are like, well, look, you know, what happens? Well, we'll get bailed out, right? So, I mean, let me take up these loans, right? And we got bailed out in the past, right? And so I just feel like it's just more of the same, right? Too much government in the space. It's going to leave these issues. Okay.
Well, one last statement on that. Yeah. I agree with you. I hope they don't do this because we've had to bail out Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac multiple times since 2008. We had to supplement their balance sheet for years with taxpayer business, right? And so I think Freddie Mac finally turned a profit maybe 2 years ago, something like that. I haven't looked at it lately. But, you know, again, stop messing with the system.
And with the lowest of bars, because we've helped them. I mean, it's just like, come on, right? Yeah. To your point, let's let the natural market, you know, clear things. But anyways, like I said, the way the government, you know, chooses to do what it does, I'm betting this probably will go through. Although I hope not. All right. Well, look, in beginning to wrap up here, let's see here. I'm just going to jettison. I guess we got to talk about this real quick, Lance, because I know both of us have been talking about it a little bit on Twitter. So I'm going to pull up this tweet here that my good friend Jesse Felder shared, where this is a chart of the excess savings in consumer personal savings accounts, right? So this is the consumer side of the equation. Trillions were pumped into the system during the COVID stimulus rescue program. And we have talked about this as the pig in the python. And at least the consumer pig in the consumer python, we'll call it. And this chart is now showing that by these calculations, the consumer pig is now through the consumer python. Now, we're not taking into account the fiscal programs that are going on to pump additional stimulus or additional funds into the economy, like through the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act and things like that. But just in looking at people's savings accounts, they ballooned, as you would expect when you send people checks in the mail. And it took a long time, longer than many thought. But it now looks like we have burned through that excess savings.
Yeah. And by the way, just keeping this in context, yes, you and I were tweeting back and forth, and you should actually bring up the original tweet, because you said that at least Lance and I can stop talking about the pig and the python. And I go, well, that doesn't, and my point was, is that's not necessarily true, because that's just the front half of the pig that's now exiting the python. All that fiscal money is still in the python. So the pig's not quite out of the python yet, but we are getting there.
We are getting there. And I think I used my analogy where we can say, well, maybe the pig is through the python. The problem is the government keeps feeding the python pork chops.
Right? Exactly.
So they've got to make their way through. Now, somebody did remind me on Twitter of my other call, which was that that now it seems like if you think the system got so distorted and the lag effect is going to end up hitting the whole system, that's almost like putting a big pill of Ozempic into the Python. Yeah. Our Python's going to start getting skinnier after all this stuff makes its way through. Is that going to happen, folks? Who knows? I think it will, but we'll keep our eyes on here and monitor it.
Yeah.
All right. So in ending up, I want to share a really interesting historic anecdote. And I think you'll like it, Lance, because you're such a data guy. One of the key things about data is different smart people can take different lessons from the same data. And the key here is really trying to be the one who interprets the data correctly. So I'm gonna pull up an image here. So just give me 2 seconds.
Yeah, this while you're doing that, there's a great quote by Howard Marks, which is, you can be right about the data, but if you're too early, you're wrong.
That's true.
And that's a very, very true statement. So, you know, it's great. You know, you have this thesis that A or B or C is going to happen, but you're so early that you don't make the right investments.
So well, exactly. And let's use my comment there about the Ozempic and the Python, right? So let's say I am right. And in, you know, some future date, the economy slows so much that we do maybe start tipping into recession and the market catches wind of that. And then there's a big market drop, right?
Yep.
And hey, we have a position for that today, but it doesn't happen, you know, until 3 years from now. And in the interim, they pass this Freddie Mac thing and that does juice the economy. And, you know, we have raging price inflation for the next year and a half. I'm totally wrong, right? Yeah. Even though I'm right in the long run, I'm totally wrong. And I'm probably wiped out if I pushed all my chips onto that side of the table, which is why you always say, you know, don't get so caught up with a conviction that you commit too much of your portfolio to it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, this is why, you know, look, that's why we look at daily trading charts about, you know, what's the market doing right now? Because that's what matters to your money right now. And again, and look, I'm not a rate, you know, people go, Lance, you're so bullish. It's like, I'm really not. I mean, if you read the articles on our, if you go to realinvestmentadvice.com and read our daily blog or our newsletter, there's plenty of good bearish commentary on there because, you know, we're looking at this long-term data and we certainly understand that the risks that are out there. And yes, we're going to have a recession. Yes, we're going to have a big market decline at some point. Now, maybe not a financial crisis, but 30-40% decline, certainly very possible over the next few years. But the problem is as we said before, is that if I go sit in a position in my portfolio, and I'm like all in cash because I'm trying to avoid the crash, well, I can lose a 50 or 60 point rise in the market, to try to avoid a 30% decline. And so, you know, it's important. This is why we try to measure out as you and I talk is like, hey, here's what's going on in the markets right now. Let's pay attention to this. These big macro themes are great to talk about. But one thing about these kind of big macro themes is that things are going to change. And, you know, if for instance, let's just pick something like you remember. So just about a year ago, you and I were having these conversations about the death of the dollar. And that was all about that was the big topic, right? The death of the dollar. Well, now the dollar's rallying like crazy. So what happened, right? Well, things changed. And so the narrative of the death of the dollar has now gone away because now it's the raging bull market of the dollar. And what does that mean, right? For the economy and for our trading partners and all those type of things. So it's important to make sure that we pay attention to what's happening right now. And that's what we manage our portfolio with. And then pay attention to these macro themes. They're important, but also realize that whatever narrative you may have today could very well change in 6 months or a year because the Fed cut rates or because we elected a new president that passed, you know, a new law that changed some dynamic in the market or, you know, whatever it is. It's always important to understand that the future is unpredictable and nobody knows how these things are going to turn out. So betting on that is very dangerous because nobody knows what the future is actually going to be.
Yeah, you know, Lance, you're making me think that we should have a discussion on one of these videos about how do you invest for a macro conviction like that, right? So a good example, your bond trade is more of a macro conviction, right?
Yeah. Yes.
But your whole portfolio isn't around that single trade. right?
Right.
So you want to have some parts of your portfolio that are there positioned almost as like sleeper cells for when your macro position, you know, is realized by the full market. But in the interim, you've got to be trading the market the way that it is.
Yeah. And look, I mean, look, let's just look at the portfolio here real quick, just to kind of put that into some perspective for.
And then I do want to come back to my data story. So
Yeah. No, absolutely. But just very quickly, I mean, look, so here's the portfolio. So if you look at a breakdown of the portfolio itself, I mean, you know, EDV, which is our bond position, it's 11% of the overall account. It's down 3.38%. So it's dragging on the portfolio, but that doesn't include all the interest income I've been picking up, because we don't reinvest dividends or income. We move it into cash. And so when that way we can use that cash to deploy elsewhere. So we don't reinvest. If I actually was reinvesting, I'd probably be closer to flat on that position. SHY, which is basically the same as cash, it makes up 10% of the portfolio. IEI is a 3 to 7 year treasury bond. It's 5% of the portfolio. 4% of the roughly about 4.5% is a 10 year treasury bond. Those are down 3%-ish, right? So, you know, those aren't huge drags on the portfolio. And if I take that weight and then I compare it to the weight in the rest of the portfolio of equities, which is performing, it's providing very little drag, right? I've got very little exposure on something that is a more major macro theme. But when that macro theme starts to mature, which should be later on this year, theoretically, or beginning of 2025, if and when that macro theme starts to mature, I'll start adding in to those positions and overweighting those positions within the portfolio. Right now, it's the equity story. So we're overweight equities relative to fixed income.
Got it. Yep. And I think it's a great example of how you are, you know, again, position for something that you've got a strong macro conviction about. And even though that hasn't been realized by the market yet, you're still providing good positive return because you are focused on what is working right now.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So just in wrapping up here, I mentioned that, you know, smart people, and I mean, turn on any news show, you know, any financial news show, you'll oftentimes see two people on different sides arguing about the same data, coming to different conclusions.
Yep.
But obviously, in most cases, one of them is going to have a clearer view of the truth than the other, or at least what pans out. And a story that has always kept me humble around this, when I felt like I'm the smarter guy at the table, right? And always forces me to check myself when I just feel the data is so, you know, compelling to me. It's the story from World War II. And we were, I think this was in the Navy. You know, they had aircraft carriers and they were, you know, losing a lot of planes, right? So they said, look, we got to figure a way to make our planes, you know, more resilient to the type of fire that they're coming under, so we can have more successful sorties and we can lose, you know, fewer human lives with lost pilots and stuff like that. And so they were trying to figure out how to do it. And somebody came up with the great idea of like, well, let's go look at the planes and see where they're getting shot, right? And so they ended up creating a schematic. And so here's the silhouette they came up with. And you can see, for those folks that are listening maybe on the podcast and don't have visuals, the planes are getting shot here. They're looking at the fuselages of the planes that, you know, made their way back to the aircraft carrier. They're looking at where they got shot. They got shot on the wings, heavily in the center of the plane, and on the tail, right? And so, understandably, everybody said, okay, great. So we got to put more armor in those areas, right? That's where the planes are getting nailed. We put heavier armor there. Hopefully it keeps our boys safe, keeps the planes in the air. We have more successful sorties. And they literally were like starting to work on this. And then a statistician named Abraham Wald ran into the room and said, no, you guys are doing this exactly backwards, exactly the wrong way. And everybody said, why? What do you mean? I mean, we're fixing the planes where they got shot. And he said, no. You're looking at the bullet holes on the planes that made it back from the sortie, right? So they were actually, you're arming up the parts of a plane that can get shot and still have the plane successfully make it back. You want to be putting it where you're not seeing bullet holes in the cockpit, on the engines, right? You know, where the gas tanks are there in the back reserves. So, you know, and everybody, once they saw through his eyes, said, oh my God, you're absolutely right. Right. So that's where they ended up armoring up the planes. It's a practice that continued not only just through World War II, but into the Korean War and future wars. It totally worked right. Abraham Wald totally saw it right. But it just goes to show sometimes the data is so obvious and so compelling, but so wrong. And so I think as an investor, you've really got to be always questioning your interpretation of the data, listening to the other side. And Lance, you probably do that a lot with your colleague, Michael Leibowitz there, challenging each other for ideas. But anyways, you're smiling as I'm telling the story. You probably had heard it before.
No, I love that story because it is such a great analogy of how you should, you know, kind of view your portfolio. And it is, you know, this is one of the good benefits I have with Michael Leibowitz, because he and I are very different personality wise. He's much more bearish than I am.
He's such a nice guy.
He's super nice. I'm an asshole. So there you go. But no, it leads to very challenging debates. And then we have this younger guy on our, which is always interesting because we have this younger guy on our team, CFA, super smart guy. But he's very young. And so he hasn't really been through, you know, a market downturn like the financial crisis. So he's like a babe in the woods, but he's got kind of more mainstream views about markets, finance, fundamentals, et cetera. So it provides a whole nother source of debate. And so as we're making these investment decisions, you know, we're debating all these issues back and forth and trying to look at all sides of the debate. And that's a benefit that a lot of people don't have, because, you know, they listen to you, right? They listen to one podcast. That's all I listen to. I just listen to Adam. He's the best thing since sliced bread. I agree, by the way. But they only listen to Adam. But the problem is you also need to listen to other people you don't agree with, because that's, again, you know, we're looking at the plane with the bullet holes that made it home. We need to look at what really may be going on in reality.
All right. Look, well, in wrapping up here, one other little anecdote from the week I wanted to share with you, Lance, was, so I'm finishing this 5-day fast I've been on. People have been so super supportive through Twitter. Thank you all. I actually feel pretty great now that I'm here on day 5. I'm really relieved that we made it through this discussion, because I wasn't sure if I was just going to be in crazy town land right now. But I actually felt surprisingly lucid.
Yeah.
But I was listening to Warren Buffett. Berkshire just had its annual meeting, and somebody actually, it was quite poignant. Like a little boy got the microphone and asked Buffett, you know, what would he do if he had one more day with Charlie Munger? And Buffett went on like a 15-minute answer. It was really kind of interesting. But in his long answer, he talked about how, you know, Munger was a guy who just really loved life, loved what he did what he loved. And but apparently said, I've never done a day of exercise in my life that I wasn't forced to do. And he said he wasn't forced to do it, because he, at one point, he was in the military for World War II, I think it was. But he said beyond those days, he like never exercised a day in his life. He didn't particularly watch what he ate. You know, Buffett famously at 93 or whatever, drinks Cokes all the time, eats Egg McMuffins, you know, for breakfast. And to a certain extent, you know, you and I talk about the importance of investing in health, and I 1000% think that's important to do. And I'll continue to do it the rest of my life. But also, like, you know, sometimes just life isn't fair, right? Sometimes people are genetically gifted or whatever, but the guys that just don't take care of themselves are the ones that live to 99, like Munger. Yeah. And sometimes it's the healthiest guy that gets, you know, the horrible diagnosis from the doctor or whatever, right?
There's a great TikTok that's been running around lately, or Twitter, I can't remember, but it shows a list of all the people that made like the treadmill, the exercise bike, all these different, you know, kind of ways to stay in shape. They all died like in their 50s. So yeah, I mean, look, I work out every day, I eat right, you know, balance my hormones, whole nine yards. My plan is to live as long as possible, but I'll probably be dead next year. So there you go.
Well, I shouldn't laugh at that. Hopefully not. Because the next year, if you're still around, Lance, we'll do a big in-person celebration.
There you go.
On the weekly market recap for your birthday. All right. So I would be totally remiss if I didn't ask you about your trades. Sounds like you've already intimated you've made a few.
Yeah. Nothing major. Actually, we didn't change equity exposure at all this week. So, you know, last week we talked about how we had added to Meta in the dividend equity model. We added to American Electric Power into the dividend equity model to diversify. And we talked about this last week, is to start building out this energy infrastructure, electric utilities for this whole AI, you know, kind of function. So this week we actually did the same thing in the equity model a bit, and we didn't change exposure at all. We've owned Duke Energy for quite some time, Duke Utilities and ExxonMobil. We were buying ExxonMobil back latter part of last year and first part of this year when energy was kind of out of favor. Those have had great returns. So we reduced those positions in the portfolio by about 1% each, took profits there. And we added 1% to a company called GE Vernova, which is the spinoff from General Electric and National Fuel Gas, which is a natural gas provider, which in the electricity generation, you do that either through nuclear, natural gas, et cetera. And again, you know, a lot of people are going, well, what about solar? What about, you know, wind? The problem with solar and wind, not saying that they're not going to be important components, because they will, but the conversion ratio of solar into actual electricity is not nearly as efficient as natural gas or uranium. So, I should say nuclear power. Obviously, you need uranium for that. But so we're adding this natural gas play into the portfolio. It has about 3% dividend yield as well, which kind of fits into our dynamics. Valuations are good. We didn't change exposure at all. We just shifted it within the portfolio.
Okay. So sorry, you added GE Vernova and National Fuel Gas. You trimmed Duke Utilities. What was the other?
ExxonMobil.
ExxonMobil. Okay. All right. Great. All right. Well, look, in wrapping up, folks, you just don't feel like you can wait an entire year to be able to celebrate Lance when he turns the big 6-0. Let him know your excitement by hitting the like button and then clicking that subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. If you'd like to talk to one of the financial advisors endorsed by Thoughtful Money, feel free to schedule a consultation with them by going to thoughtfulmoney.com. I think I mentioned this to folks last week. We're almost kind of being victims of our own success here, in the sense that we have so many people reaching out to do this. We love it. Keep doing it, folks, if you want to talk to these folks. Only do so if you're really ready to, bring all the information, arrive prepared with all your questions that you want to get answered, and be willing to take action on what you learn. These guys are very busy, managing their current clients, their current portfolios, and talking to all of you that are reaching out, and they love to talk to you guys. But the more sort of prepared and the more action oriented you are, the better it is for everybody. And like I said, if you've got a good financial advisor who's, already meeting your needs, and they take into account all the things that Lance and I talked about, great. But if not, if you'd like a second opinion from these advisors, maybe even Lance himself, reach out, fill out that form. All right, Lance, let's see what else. That's one thing I forgot to remind folks of. So I think maybe I said at the very beginning, if you have yet to subscribe to the free newsletter, make sure you go do that again. There's all sorts of benefits you get for free or if you upgrade, but the key reason why I'm asking people to do that right now, especially if you're a regular viewer of this channel, is if for some reason YouTube goes dark on us at some point in the future, hopefully that doesn't happen, but if it does, we've got a way to still stay in direct communication, and I can still get these interviews out to you. So to do that, again, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com. You click the little newsletter link up there in the site menu and you sign up, and it takes literally like 2 seconds. All right, Lance, as usual, I'm going to let you have the last word, buddy.
Yeah, just actually on that topic, while you're talking about that, is I had to block. I reported 3 impersonators of you this past week. I probably reported 7 of me this past week. Really important that, look, Adam is never going to reach out to you personally. He's not going to DM you asking you to pay for something. I'm not going to reach out to you asking you to invest money in something. We don't use Telegram. So if you're getting something by Telegram, that's not us. If we're DMing you directly going, hey, put some money in this, that's not us. So just realize there's a lot of impersonators, a lot of scammers out there. And so, subscribing to the Substack, you know, that is a good way to know you're actually getting information from Adam, from me, et cetera, and not from some scammer. Just be careful. There's so many of these things that are going on.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I actually had it in my notes and I forgot to mention it here. And it's weird, Les, like these things come in waves, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know right now, but it's almost like cicada season, right? Like I don't know why, but they're just coming out of the woodwork right now. And some of these, I got to say, like, it's frustrating that most of these social platforms don't have better anti-scammer tools and software yet. And there's been one on Twitter that people have been reaching out to me now for like 3 months saying, hey, you know, Adam, is this you? They certainly look like you and sound like you, but they're asking me if I want to buy this from them. And they're not. And the handle, and I think it's like on Twitter, it's like Menlo Bear PB, I think is what it is. Yeah. I'm just at Menlo Bear at Twitter. Anything other than that, misspelled or whatever, not me. I tell those people, hey, look, they've already blocked me, that scam account, so I can't report them to Twitter, but please, can you? And I probably had, I don't know, 100 people say, yeah, I blocked and reported them to Twitter, yet they're still out there. I don't know why Twitter hasn't shut the account down yet.
And listen, I have the same problem, and Twitter's function, if I want to go report one myself, their whole system to make the report as the actual owner of the account is broken. So you can't submit the documents that you need through their platform. And it used to work. And then after Elon took it over, it got broke for some reason. But like, I can't even report spam accounts on my behalf. I have to get other people to do them as well, but then they don't go away either. So I'm not sure anything's actually being done. So the point is to be sure, just make sure that, you know, you're dealing with who you think you're dealing with before you start responding, particularly sending them any information or sending them money or whatever.
All right. Yeah. Well, just, hey, folks, even if Lance and I ourselves are reaching out to you on some social media platform, which we will never do, don't send money.
Yeah.
just good blanket policy. All right. Well, we'll leave it
there. If you want to send me money, my address is not.
all right. Well, look, and if you want to send Lance money, don't. You should send it to me.
Exactly.
But anyways, Lance, thanks for yet another week, buddy. Really appreciate it. It's crazy making to be here in Houston and to actually not be hanging out with you live. Yep. I wish you the best of birthdays.
Thank you.
Look forward to hearing the highlights when you're on next week. But thanks so much, buddy. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.